This is number 273 of the 2014 Sunstone Symposium, British LDS Fiction Conflicts and Contexts, which is the session that I am most excited about. I have read both of these books that they're going to be talking about, and they're both really good and fascinating in many ways, in which I hope we will talk much about. So we're going to hear from both of them, and then we're going... Is Brock here? Hi, Brock. Okay. It's good to meet you. And then Brock Cheney is going to be responding at the end, and then we'll open it up for question and answer period. But now we will turn it over to
our stars. You can stay there or you can stay up?
Stay.
Right.
Will you do the button for me?
Yes, I will.
Thank you.
Hello, everybody. Is this okay?
Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, I'm going to start off with three quotations. You will probably all be quite familiar with them. Number one, Orson Whitney, we will yet have Milton's and Shakespeare's of our own, and we'll build a literature whose top will touch heaven. And he was talking right back in 1888 about the idea of a Mormon literature. The next one is much later, 1994, Michael J. Austin. Embedded in the assertion that there is such a thing as Mormon literature is the claim that we as Mormons, and particularly as American Mormons, represent a cultural entity whose traditions, heritage, and experience deserve to be considered a vital part of the American mosaic. And then our last quotation is from Harold Bloom, around the same time, 1992. A major American poet, perhaps one called a Gentile by the Latter-day Saints, sometime in the future will write their early story as the epic it was. Nothing else in all of American history strikes me as materia poetica equal to the early Mormons. And he goes on. These three ideas from these three men talking about literature are central to the thoughts that Caris and I are going to be presenting to you this afternoon. The first, that such a thing as a Mormon literature can exist or is something worthy to strive towards, that there may even be a spiritual element to a creative practice, a drawing closer to heaven. The second idea is from Austin, that this Mormon literature should be more or less integrated with the larger cultural life of society and form part of an exchange or a dialogue with this society, and that the larger cultural life will be an American one. The Mormon writer will be contributing to an American mosaic, and that term mosaic has been quite important to both of us. Finally, from Bloom, the authors of this LDS literature may not be institutionally Mormon, may indeed be Gentile, come from without the tent of Zion, but in his estimation they will be from the US. So, those are the three thoughts that we plan to explore with particular reference to our own work, our status as British writers with Mormon sensibilities, publishing with mainstream British publishing houses, and presenting our work to a general readership who know very little about LDS doctrine and culture. If you could move us along. Thank you. When it's your turn, I'll swap and I'll do it. I promise. Okay, so I'm going to introduce my novel to you, The Friday Gospels. It's a story told over one day by five different narrators, and it tells the story of the day that their son, Gary, comes home from his mission. He's been in Utah, but they all come from Preston Stake, Chorley, where the temple is in particular. And something that was really important to me was to use recognisable Mormon stereotypes during my novel and to subvert them. So one of the characters is an unfaithful, lukewarm husband, a kind of slacker Mormon, who becomes, by the end of the novel, the steadying force in the family. Gary is a young, keen missionary. He is sees everything in black and white, and he becomes able, by the end of the novel, to exist in ethical shades of grey. He gets a much more sophisticated sense of moral and ethics. The mother, who is sick, self-centred, she's a busybody, and she becomes the open-hearted matriarch. We have also an angry anti-Mormon. No novel would be complete without him. And he becomes the hero of the novel. He saves the family by giving a very Christ-like sacrifice. And Karis will speak further about stereotypes a little later on. For me, fiction is a mode of inquiry. Like science, it is one of the most risky and surprising ways of asking questions we have open to us. Fiction is also only ever one part of a conversation, a complicated dance between the reader and the writer, the various masks and personae the reader and writer employ, and between the text and other cultural ideas and artefacts it acknowledges and is acknowledged by. So, some of my questions. The Friday Gospels, obviously a British novel. I am British, it is set in England. How could this be part of the American mosaic? Did my novel fit into this at all? How could I contribute to a home literature when the US was not my home? How far could a writer or a Mormon stretch the thread of belonging without breaking it? Why would I want to? These were personal as well as literary questions, and I did not know the answer to them when I began. I did set off in my writing, knowing as a British writer with a Mormon background, I had always experienced a strange kind of doubleness. We share our language with our brothers and sisters in Utah, but we are very different. We're certainly not European, although in our hubris, we do like to consider ourselves the capital of European Mormonism. We even tried to celebrate Pioneer Day with you, but we are the ones who stayed put, who got with the program too late to make the trek to Zion, or who were quite simply left behind. And this is something that they're quite conscious of in UK Mormon culture. So I'm going to read you a tiny bit now with one hand. You're going to now, aren't you? Okay. Okay. You're a lovely helpmate. So, Carol is Gary's girlfriend. He's just about to go on his mission. They're going for a walk around the Stake Centre to look at Preston Temple. He's absolutely besotted with her. He wants to marry her. And he is reflecting a little bit on the time they've had together and on when he first realised that she was indeed the woman for him. Carol didn't say anything. She's so small. She comes up to the second button down on my shirt and she smiled. I used to get teased about him when I was at school, she said. About who? Moroni. There are myths about him. Apparently, the Brethren in Salt Lake pay Manchester Airport £1 million a year to divert the aeroplanes that fly over the temple, in preference to painting over the shining gilt of his robes, which distracted the pilots. Or, the top of his head opens up and the Urim and Thummim are inside of it, stored there because we're the oldest stake in the world. Lancashire, the home of the first European Mormons, landing place of the very first missionaries, and Heavenly Father has got a soft spot in his heart for us. Or, when the second coming is near, Moroni will come to life and blow his horn, and on that signal, we'll all pack up our stuff and travel to Missouri to assemble ourselves in the Garden of Eden and wait for Jesus to come and start the millennium. Or, because the temple itself costs so much, they ran out of tithing money, so Moroni is actually made of spray-painted polystyrene, replaced annually in the dead of night between Christmas and New Year. And that's just what we say about ourselves. We all got teased about him, I said. One of Julian's friends, that's Gary's brother, the angry ex-Mormon, asked him if the trumpet really worked. If, when we heard it, we all came to the temple, no matter what time of day it was, went up into the spire, fastened our seatbelts as the whole thing took off, and took us to the moon. Carol laughed, but very gently, with her hand against her top lip. I'm going to miss out a bit. He sort of tries to flirt with her unsuccessfully, and it's embarrassing for all of us. So I'm just going to skip to when he starts remembering how they met. I didn't tell her, but right then I was thinking about the first time I caught sight of her and knew, without a shadow of a doubt, that Heavenly Father had sent her here for me to be my wife. I'd have been 16, I'm sure. Maybe 17. It was Pioneer Day. Jeannie, that's his little sister, was in the primary parade and had spent most of the day in a prairie dress and bonnet, being pushed around in a wagon made out of a cardboard and fabric-covered supermarket trolley. Mum had been learning to make quilted scripture cases with the rest of the sisters in Relief Society, and me and Julian had been on a pioneer-themed treasure hunt on Beacon Fell. Now it was night time, and we'd all eaten, and the whole stake had got together in the cultural hall for the talent shows. They'd set it up like a theatre, dark with a stage at one end lit up by spotlights because we were doing the road shows. Each would skit or song or performance over, and us being certain we'd won it until Carol and the rest of the youth from her ward got up, all dressed in black, and every one of them wearing cool, dark glasses. They all had instruments of one kind or another, and between them they played Living on a Prayer. Carol in the middle with her knees around the big wooden boat of her cello and her head down, her hair falling all around her face because she was so shy about being on stage. Everyone else was roaring and stamping and clapping, but I just leaned against the wall, forgot to keep an eye on Julian, and stared. If I felt anything at all, it was awe and a sense of gratitude and comfort in the knowledge that when the path is the right one, the way is always clear.
Thank you. You're welcome.
So much can be lost in translation, sunk in the water between our two cultures. We are a satellite to a main congregation, and within British Mormonism there's a recurrent anxiety about culture and doctrine, how to separate the two. I talked about my research questions as a creative practitioner. As a Mormon, I had lots and lots of very childlike questions. What does dating mean? Why do all the recipes in my cookbooks call for US measures and ingredients? What is corn syrup? Why do all the children who get letters published in The Friend come from Provo, Orem, Bountiful? What do apricot trees look like? Is that how popcorn is really made? Are the people writing and publishing these texts really speaking to us? And I'm going to read you just one extra extract and hand over to Caris. So this is an extract from much earlier in the novel. And Jeannie, she's just had a quite disturbing seminary class. She's quite confused by what she's been taught. I'm not going to read that bit, but I'm going to read the immediate aftermath. Now Sister Williams takes the book and stands in front of the television and speaks to us for a while about whitewater rafting and how dangerous it can be and how boat crews overcome this danger by working in a team, which is to represent the family, and remind us that eternal families are built through celestial marriage only. Brother Fletcher, who's never been married, and it's probably too late now unless a widow moves into the ward from somewhere else, has a large colour picture of a raft floating down a steep-looking incline, water foaming around the side, and a family in matching yellow helmets and life jackets holding hands inside the boat. He stands next to her and jiggles the picture now and again. The room is filled with her soft monotone and the click of the radiators. Sister Williams gives us all a little clip art picture of a raft on a river that she has printed on her computer and cut out with pinking shears and then laminated. She tells us to stick them to the inside of our lockers when we get to school, so that whenever we open them to get our books, we'll be reminded of the important role we play in our celestial family and how our families rely on us. But the lockers at our school don't work like that. Hardly anyone has got one. But the lesson book is American, printed in Salt Lake, where Gary's been, and where the high school students have lockers as tall as they are and they're allowed to visit them 10 times a day. It's not like that for us, but because the lesson book says it, Sister Williams has got to say it, and we listen and hold the little pictures carefully anyway.
Shall I swap with you?
It's all right. It's fine. Okay.
Actually,
I don't want to do that yet. Okay.
In his essay, Imaginary Homelands, Salman Rushdie refers to an old picture of his family home in Bombay. Although the past is frequently described as a foreign country, Rushdie notes that the photograph of his old family home acts as a reminder that his present is foreign, and that the past is home, albeit a lost home in a lost city, in the mists of lost time. To grow up Mormon in England in the 70s and 80s was to grow up in a post-correlation environment, something that's been discussed at a Wheat and Tares blog titled Growing Up Mormon in Britain, which is really interesting, and I recommend it. The church in Europe is largely made up of post-war converts who have little inkling of the Mormon intellectual world and understand church history in the context of the missionary discussions and the church lesson manuals. When I was growing up, I felt distant from the main body of the church in Utah, but I lived and breathed stories of the place and its people. In sacrament meetings, we sang about Zion, and as a girl, I noticed that many of the hymns about Zion mentioned mountains. There's just a few of them, okay? Although I knew that the word Zion referred to the pure in heart, as well as a physical place, and although it could be argued that some of the mountain references were metaphorical, it was clear to me that the landscape to which those songs referred was not mine. I live in what is probably one of the flattest towns in Britain. The only hills in my towns are man-made hills that are railway bridges. In primary, we sang pioneer songs from the Orange Sing With Me songbook. We watched films and read stories about the people who left our country for a better life. And we recited the 10th article of faith. We believe in the literal gathering of Israel, in the restoration of the 10 tribes, that Zion will be built upon the American continent, that Christ will reign personally upon the earth, and that the earth will be renewed and receive its paradisical glory. I should have been able to recite that, but maybe not. Some wards celebrated Pioneer Day. I have even heard of others marking Independence Day, an unusual anniversary for British citizens to commemorate. Today, British youth leaders are beginning to adopt the trend of staging reenactments of pioneer journeys, and last year marked the first ever British pageant. Unlike Rushdie's Indian home, which exists in the past, the imaginary home of British Mormons exists in the past and in the present. It is thousands of miles away, but it doesn't have to be hundreds of years away, because its influence pervades the stories of the past and extends to the stories and the culture of the present. The effect is that British Mormons can sometimes feel like expatriates, spiritual citizens of a homeland that is described in song and in story, but remains, for the majority, a largely imagined place. It's all right, I think I'll do it. I'm just going to read you a little bit from my novel, and I'm going to read from the... This is the American edition, which is out next week. But I'm going to read from the British proof, which means that it's full of anglicisms, so I hope you will understand them. It seemed appropriate to keep them in for this presentation. So I'm going to read you a little section, which is from the point of view of the dad of the family, as he is driving home from a church meeting. Ian sings along to a Tabernacle Choir CD as he drives home from Liverpool. His voice is loud and quite tuneful. He likes to pretend the Tabernacle Choir is accompanying him, so he keeps his own time and adds extra vibrato to the longer notes like a soloist. Driving along the dock road makes him feel small, an insignificant speck of humanity alongside the looming structures and machinery of industry. He passes the empty, crumbling acropolis of the tobacco warehouse, Goliathan container cranes and industrial buildings, the railway line, a fire station, car dealerships, and a Chinese supermarket graze his peripheral vision, but the arc of his imagination is occupied by the docks. By soot-streaked red bricks, the crisscross of coloured and corrugated metals, iron railings, concrete, and occasional snapshot slices of ships. Ian is a pioneer. He drives a Toyota Estima, but if the situation arose, he knows he would be equally at home with a covered wagon, or even a handcart. Brother Rimmer's got a handcart in his garage. He constructed it in the 70s in preparation for the trek to Zion, back when people still talked about fleeing to Jackson County, Missouri, and it seemed like the second coming was just around the corner, before the brethren told everyone to stay put and build Zion in their own communities. When Ian was a small boy, Brother Rimmer used to pull his handcart to church activities and give the children rides around the car park while they sang pioneer songs and pretended to shoot Indians. The pleasure of this memory makes Ian sing louder. He wishes he'd been born 200 years ago, when the docks were the gateway to Zion and the first Mormon missionaries landed in Liverpool. He would like to wind back time and begin his pioneer journey with baptism in the River Mersey. Imagine crossing the sea to America and embarking on the 1,000-mile trek to Utah. The pioneers made enormous sacrifices and they endured tremendous trials. His own life has been disappointingly easy by comparison. He was baptized indoors, and although the water in the font was lukewarm because the heating wasn't working properly, and he shivered a bit as he changed out of his wet clothes, it was certainly no hardship. And there was a party afterwards with a big cake which said, "Happy 8th birthday, welcome Ian," in white chocolate buttons, and he felt as if his life had finally started, as if everything up to that point had just been a practice, a dry run for the moment when he would begin playing for keeps. He's been fortunate, blessed, in fact. He's barely suffered at all. He has a happy marriage, 4 children, a satisfactory job, and for just over a year he's served the church in his role as bishop of the local congregation, an enormous responsibility. He was called to be bishop on Father's Day, and after he took his place on the stand behind the pulpit, the primary children sang a song about fathers and family with a special second verse addressed entirely to the bishop, to him. As he listened to their singing, Ian made a quiet promise to always be there for the primary children and their families. And since that time, there have been frequent opportunities to make small sacrifices, such as the ones he's made today. It's a shame to have missed Jacob's birthday party. But these things don't begin to compare to the things the pioneers gave up. The gospel is all about serving people. It's what Jesus would do if he were here. And then, just a little bit later in that chapter, he is remembering a time when he was at the docks with the children, when the tall ships came to the docks and they went down to see them. Later, he'll make notes for the talk he'll deliver at church tomorrow, a talk he's been mentally preparing for the past few days. He'll speak about sacrifice. He'll mention missing Jacob's party as an illustration. And he'll also tell a story about the children, which will go some way to making up for not seeing much of them this weekend. He likes to use real life stories in his talks because they have a greater impact on the congregation. Plus, he looked up self-sacrifice on the internet last week during his lunch hour, and all that came up was a list of tattoo and body piercing providers. The children will pretend to be embarrassed, but he knows they'll be secretly pleased to have been mentioned. He'll tell the story of the time the tall ships came to Liverpool and he bundled the family into the car and drove them to the docks. It felt as if they had just emerged from a time machine as they walked along the Salt House dock that day. The water was swimming with square riggers and brigs, ketches and cutters. The schooners looked like they'd sailed to Liverpool straight from the set of Treasure Island. The pylon structures of their masts were strewn with bunting. "Look," he said to the children, sweeping both arms in an attempt to conduct their reactions. "Let's imagine we're about to get on a boat to travel to America. We're going to be pioneers, and we've got to leave everything behind that we can't carry. When we get to America, we're going to walk 1,000 miles to Utah. Imagine how exciting it would be." At first, no one responded, but everyone was hungry, and he'd been holding the carrier bag of brown bread sandwiches. Holding the lunch to ransom proved to be an imagination activator. "I'm sure it would be exciting at first," Zipporah said. But I bet we'd be seasick. Yes, that shows you're really thinking about it. Could I take my Lego with me? Jacob asked. No, Ian explained. You'd have to make sacrifices. You know what a sacrifice is, don't you, Jacob? It's when you give up something good for something better. So I'd get more Lego in America. No, you'd get something much better than Lego. Blessings for being obedient and eternity with your family. Everyone waited for Alma to say something. I'm excited, he finally conceded. Can I have a sandwich? In a minute, Ian said. First, I'd like it if we could sing a pioneer song. They'd all groaned, even Claire. But it was a groan laced with affection, a groan which told him that, even though they didn't want to admit it, they were enjoying themselves and didn't mind singing on the dockside like a Scouse version of the Von Trapp family. Let's do Whenever I Think About Pioneers, he said. Just think about what they sacrificed so we can have the gospel today. After three. It had been a special moment. He'd felt the reassuring warmth of the Spirit in his heart as they sang the simple words in honour of the sacrifices of their pioneer forebearers. The bunting on the tall ships flapped applause at them, and although they'd sung quietly, Ian's heart filled with gratitude as he looked at the children and Claire. They probably looked like an ordinary family standing on the dockside. They probably didn't. But they weren't. They aren't. They're an eternal family, sealed to each other by the power and authority of the priesthood forever and ever. Like the pioneers, they'll be called upon to make sacrifices for the sake of their beliefs, and like the pioneers, they won't falter. He'll describe that special faith-enhancing moment in sacrament meeting tomorrow, a moment so perfect it hadn't been spoilt by Alma's improvised second verse, which began, "I would like to have died of frostbite." Okay. When discussing the act of writing about India as an expatriate, Salman Rushdie notes, "If literature is in part the business of finding new angles at which to enter reality, then once again our distance, our long geographical perspective, may provide us with such angles." As British Mormons, we listened to and read the stories of the pioneers and the story of Mormonism itself from a distance. Distance alters perspective, and so when we write about Mormonism, it will necessarily be a different kind of Mormonism. When portraying a minority experience, there is a risk that the majority may view the writing as inauthentic or inaccurate. And my novel has already been criticised by an American Mormon reviewer for not depicting a normal Mormon community. The reviewer believes her experience of religious community is normative, but she doesn't inhabit a post-correlation world of British Mormonism. And it doesn't seem to occur to her that although we share the same stories and sing the same songs, there may be significant differences between our worlds. The world of British Mormonism is characterised by a culture of obedience. It's a world where wards are often split as soon as there is enough priesthood to form a second unit. A world where it's not unusual for there to be church meetings or commitments 5 or 6 nights of the week. A world where a stake president may make a 200-mile round trip to give a sacrament talk. A world where it can be difficult to separate culture from doctrine because much of the culture in church magazines and lesson manuals is, despite our shared language, foreign.
Thank you. I'm going to stick with this idea of home, the idea that a writer can be one of our own. And Caris, as you've just heard, has already spoken about what to us home might mean in terms of culture, language and landscape, what it might feel like to be a reader and writer of a home away from home, or engaged in the imaginative work of relating to a home you've never visited. She's already quoted from Rushdie's essay, and me too, I too found that essay useful when exploring my practice in this area. He says, "I suggest that the writer who is out of country and even out of language may experience this loss of the homeland in an intensified form. It is made more concrete for him by the physical fact of discontinuity, of his present being in a different place from his past, of his being elsewhere. This may enable him to speak properly and concretely on a subject of universal significance and appeal. I have been looking really hard for LDS fiction written by writers outside of the US and representing global LDS cultures. I still am. Growing up, and indeed even as an adult looking at the Mormon coloured tiles and the American mosaic, I still wasn't sure I wanted to inhabit. It seemed to me that the LDS fiction I was reading had a peculiar conception of place, of home. There were two places in the world, Utah and the mission field. I noticed that when non-US Mormon cultures and contexts are dramatised, too often it is by a US writer who makes the outside world other. Often these stories explore the site of cultural exchange that the mission program could be at its very best from the point of view of an American missionary. The only stories in Dispensation, which is a really excellent short fiction anthology, but the only stories that aren't set in the US are written by US authors, and they have been critiqued for presenting images of France and Africa through American eyes, using cliché and broad brush representations of place. In writing the Friday Gospels, I wanted to turn this literary tradition, this habit we seem to have, upside down and make the experience of the non-US missionary visiting the imaginary homeland, his motherland, what his mother calls the source or Salt Lake City. And it is his perceptions of this homeland that are unfounded, containing as much post-correlation prejudice and ignorance as I could muster. Gary comes from a really small community, tight-knit, geographically entwined with its locality, but set apart, held separate. Chorley, Lancashire, home of the Preston Temple. Locally, its nickname is Little Utah. And this isn't a sarcastic dig at the population from a non-Mormon community. It is a hopeful piece of wish fulfillment from a small enclave of converts and left-behinds who are more determined to be more like whatever they imagine Utah Mormon communities to be. Gary's had a picture of the Salt Lake Temple on his bedroom wall since he was 11. His family have an emergency preparation kit for the natural disaster that will never strike his green, pleasant and temperate of weather land. Gary eats cracked wheat with his family, but only because his mother orders it over the internet and has it delivered by airmail. They have Relief Society and Young Women's handouts on the wall at home, and all the spelling is in US English. So I'm going to read to you now from Gary's piece. And in this chapter, America, our imaginary spiritual homeland, strangely familiar to a British Mormon, is forced by a combination of Gary's inexperience, hope, prejudice, and sheer overwhelming exhaustion to become other. In a discomforting experience that will contribute to Gary making a life-altering decision, home becomes not home, inhospitable and even unheimlich, uncanny, unhomely. Home is not where the heart is. This is the place where you are now, not where you came from. I'm fine, yeah. On the M6, passing Stoke. The car windows are smeared with the greasy handprints of Bishop Jackson's children, and James was right. The jet lag really is worse this way round. Maybe that's why I feel so bad. Jet lag isn't just about being tired or wanting your breakfast in the middle of the night. Though the tiredness is part of it. The bone-deep soul exhaustion that leaves you weeping at the array of options on the boards in Denny's window. When I arrived in Salt Lake, feeling like it was 3 a.m. when most Utahns were just settling down after their dinners, I felt like I'd come to a washed-out, watered-down version of all the pictures I'd ever seen. Maybe it is the fatigue that reduces the world to something else, something faded and remote and too familiar at the same time. People have been telling me for months how huge the country would seem to me, how vast and inspiring I would find the experience of being stateside after existing in one tiny corner of one tiny island all my life. How strange I would find it, they said, that these people would drive 4 hours to go to an outlet store and 4 hours back, all on the one day. But all I noticed was how small the place felt. The city itself, a series of strip malls on the sides of the freeway with a glossy postcard of the snowy Wasatch Front propped up against the horizon. Downtown filled with actors dressed up as tourists, office workers, missionaries. Films about America are larger than life, but America is just itself. But it wasn't just America I was going to. It was Utah. For this trolley boy, the Beehive State was the motherland, beautiful Deseret. I'd been told I'd feel, being among members the whole time, like I'd gone home. Bishop Jackson told me I wasn't leaving home. I was going home to be with my greater family, the rest of the saints in Zion. We knew members who'd saved up and moved there. The Harris family were in Bountiful and had promised to introduce me to some non-member friends of theirs. Alan Redbury had won a scholarship to BYU and had married there, lived for a year in Provo, had a son, then moved to Idaho. Even Sister Travers had a niece in from one of the Shropshire wards. She'd fallen in love with a missionary from Brigham City. 2 weeks after her missionary had arrived home, she'd received an airmail package containing a photograph of his mother and father standing on the steps of the family home, a diamond ring and a one-way plane ticket. It's romantic. So, why was going to church there almost a disappointment? The profusion of chapels, identical red brick buildings with white spires and satellite dishes, the comforting lettering of the sign, the same all over the world, the franchise, the logo, the green hymn books, the cry rooms, the little plastic cups full of water slotted into their holes in the sacrament trays, women crying as they bore their testimony, or took their children up to the stand and whispered the words into their ears, so even the little ones could tell us what they knew to be true. Mum had made the place out to be some sort of mecca, and I was disappointed. She'd said that the saints in Utah were more faithful because they were closer to the source. These people didn't have to waste their time defending their faith, justifying their practices to outsiders. They could just get on with living it. But in the end, it was no different to the way it had been at home, and I never thought to ask her if that was the case. Why was it that the prophet had been led to send me there? What's one more missionary in a ward where half the membership are wearing tags? And now, I really am coming home. I've never seen Chorley on the television. No one's ever made a blockbuster film set in Astley Village or Clayton Brook. In the world's greater mind, these places are so shrunken, they are invisible. And in my mind, too. I put home away, along with Carol, my Xbox, my little garden, my secret thoughts about university. I have locked up home, along with my other childish things, in the secret pocket of my suitcase that contained the calendar I used to mark off the days. All 731 of them. My days, gifts given freely to the church. The tithe of my life.
I think it's you. Hang on.
Yeah, I think it is too.
Okay. Yeah,
sure. Yeah. Great. Okay. In an excellent TED talk, Chimamanda Adichie addresses the danger of a single story. Adichie grew up in Africa, reading British novels. When she started writing, she wrote stories like the ones she had read. Stories containing white characters who talked about the weather and drank ginger beer, a drink she had never tasted. Looking back on this time, she says it taught her how impressionable and vulnerable we are in the face of a story, particularly as children. When Adichie discovered African books, her perspective changed. She realised that black girls could exist in literature, and she started to write about things she recognised. I loved those American and British stories I read. They stirred my imagination. They opened up new worlds for me. But the unintended consequence was that I did not know that people like me could exist in literature. So what the discovery of African writers did for me was this. It saved me from having a single story of what books are. What is bad about a single story? Well, Adichie asserts the single story creates stereotypes, and the problem with stereotypes is not that they are untrue, but that they are incomplete. They make one story become the only story. The characters in my novel look to American stories for inspiration. The Sweetwater Rescue, The Miracle of the Gulls, and the Pioneer Exodus itself. All stories that take place in a distant time and landscape. I could have relied entirely on these traditional stories as I describe the spiritual lives of my British characters, but writing is not just an act of transcription, it's also one of transformation. And in the case of writing about Mormonism for a British audience, I believe it also has to be an act of translation. This was something that I was keen to attempt as I placed the three Nephites in a British landscape. Correlation, by its very nature, resists transformation and translation. A Book of Mormon seminary lesson about the three Nephites contains the following warning. Avoid speculation about the three Nephites. Many have heard stories about the supposed visits of the three Nephites. Rather than share these stories, teach what is taught in the scriptures. Remember Mormon's statement that the three Nephites would be among the Gentiles and the Jews who would know them not. Refrain from discussion, I should say, of stories. Have I missed it out? That's good. Of other information that is not found in church-approved sources. So the church is attempting to preserve a correlated and consequently static narrative. But people love stories. And if they aren't allowed to tell them in lessons, they'll repeat them in whispers instead. In the Encyclopedia of Mormonism, stories of members' interactions with the three Nephites are described thus. In the stories, the three Nephites continue to bless people, and in telling these stories, Latter-day Saints continue to testify to the validity of church teachings and to encourage obedience to them. The stories continue to provide the faithful with a sense of security in an unsure world, persuading them that just as God helped righteous pioneers overcome a hostile physical world, so will he help the faithful endure the evils of urban society. Taken as a whole, then, the stories continue to provide understanding of the hearts and minds of Latter-day Saints and of the beliefs that move them to action. While members may feel the need to testify of such stories in whispers, LDS writers have not been shy about exploring the legend of the three Nephites in their fiction. Maureen Whipple's story, They Did Go Forth, is a classic three Nephite narrative. On a winter's night, one of the Nephites is conjured by a frantic mother, arriving just in time to anoint and bless her dangerously sick daughter. In Wild Sage, another story of maternal distress, all three Nephites appear when a mother receives news that her son is unwell while serving his mission. Gather some sage, one of the men advises. Send it to your son. Tell him to make tea. He'll be all right. These narratives follow the pattern of the whispered stories I heard as a child. At a great time of need, one or more of the Nephites appears. The interactions between immortal Nephite and awed human are reverent and dignified, and the resulting stories are suitable for recitation, even if it has to be done in private. Not all such fiction is reverent. In Levi Peterson's The Third Nephite, a hitchhiker called Simpson is revealed to be one of the Nephites traveling from Vegas to his next divine assignment, which is to rescue a man, Otis, from the sins of polygamy and radicalization. Peterson's story is full of comic, crude speech, and he takes his usual scatological approach, regularly referencing a wide variety of bodily functions. It's not the kind of story one would repeat in church. Brian Everson's story, Sanctified in the Flesh, also resists pious repetition. A man called Briggs, his car breaks down, and when another car stops, Briggs' wife notices that the car contains three men, and she is reassured. She retains her faith as she is robbed by the three men. She continues to believe in the goodness of the three men as they lead her away and shoot her in the head. Briggs is dispensed with moments later. When I decided to include the Nephites in A Song for Izzy Bradley, my novel, I opted to make them as ordinary as possible. I wanted 14-year-old Alma Bradley's experience with the three men to be ambiguous, but significant enough that he may feel compelled to recount it to another church member. In my novel, the three men appear in a very English landscape, a soccer field, on a dew-drenched autumn morning, walking a little dog. They rescue Alma Bradley from a fist fight and provide him with an important piece of information. Afterwards, Alma decides that what happened could be a miracle. It's as much a miracle as the approved stories he has heard at church, stories about impossibly righteous, long since dead people. And it's certainly more appealing and relevant because despite his cynicism and his awkwardness, despite the fact that he probably doesn't deserve it, it has happened to him. And I'm just going to read you a little bit of that bit where Alma is rescued by three men who might be the three Nephites. They might not be as well. It's up to the reader to decide. Death of the author. It's the reader's job. It's not like a proper fight on the TV. Al tries to throw punches, but his arms aren't fast enough. He moves more like a windmill than a boxer. And while he's flailing, their knuckles sneak past his defences and clout his head and his cheek. Fists don't bounce, they smack. And Al is surprised at how little spring there is in the space between his bones and his skin. He keeps thrashing, makes contact with something, feels like an ear, and is rewarded with a thump in the mouth. He gasps as his top teeth puncture his lip. He wishes he was brave, but he's scared and hurting. "Hey, stop it!" The voice belongs to an adult, and it's coming from somewhere behind him. The relief sends Al all bendy. His arms droop and he has to sit down. As soon as his butt hits the grass, one of the lads kicks him. And the bruise leaks down his thigh and he rolls onto his side. "Leave the boy alone!" Two more kicks. One near his kidney, the other somewhere else. He isn't sure where because the pain in his back is roaring. "Stop it!" The same voice calls, closer now. The two lads jog away towards Al's bike. He watches as they grab his rucksack from the handlebars and empty everything out onto the grass. He breathes carefully, trying to keep rhythm with the pulse in his back as the spotty lad picks his blazer off the ground, frisks it and empties the pockets. When the pain slips past its peak, he starts to feel other things all at once in a big rush. The wet grass soaking into the butt of his trousers, the pain of the second kick to his calf, it turns out, and the lump inside his lip that's beating like a small heart. He touches his mouth with the tips of his fingers and they come away bloodied. The spotty lad waves something he has pulled out of Al's blazer pocket. He and his mate tussle over it. Jostling and shoving each other, Al can't think what could possibly be of any interest to either of them. "Leave his stuff alone," a different voice calls. Al finally looks over his shoulder. Three old men are shuffling towards him. One of them has a dog, a daft dog in a little red coat. He turns back, rests his head on his knees and watches the lads wrestle. "I've got my phone," one of the old men calls. "It's got a camera, can take a photograph of you." The lads go all out in a final scrap. They tear at something and shout at each other before they run away. Are you all right? Gloved hands reach out and tug at Al's elbows and shoulders. Come on, lad, that's it. There you go. Let's get you on your way to school. He struggles to his feet. His knees are slack and his trousers are stuck to his butt. There's no way he's going to school with a wet butt and wobbly legs. The men surround him. They tap his back and shoulders and shepherd him towards his bike, muttering to him and each other. Poor lad. I've been on the end of some hidings in my time. Me too. You're not hurt badly, are you? Al shakes his head and runs his tongue over the burst in his lip. If we'd been able to move a bit faster. I've not been able to move quickly since the 90s. The 1890s? Very funny. Three old men. Three men with skin like battered leather. Purple noses and massive ears. Flat caps, anoraks, mad eyebrows like dog's whiskers. They're ancient, and there's three of them. Al's breath catches in his throat, and he is assailed by a spluttery sort of laugh. He's been rescued by the three Nephites. It's a bloody miracle. The three Nephites, last seen changing a tire on the M58, are here in the park, demonstrating that the Lord is looking out for him. There's clearly no other explanation. Wait till he tells Brother Rimmer. So, and then he cycles to Brother Rimmer's house. And Brother Rimmer is an old man from the ward who has been watching out for Alma Bradley when nobody else has. And Brother Rimmer is sort of the guy in Sunday school who, when their missionaries have investigators, they don't want this guy to say anything. But he is a very kind and loving man who is watching out for this boy in the ward who needs somebody to watch out for him. Al stands on the pedals, but the position magnifies the ache in his thigh, so he sits down and decides to take his time. He explores the new contours of his lip with his tongue and thinks about what's happened. The old men have gifted him a story. He's discovered the password to a club that's excluded him for years. He's pretty sure he doesn't want to join, but he could. He could tell people if he wanted. He pictures himself standing at the pulpit on Fast and Testimony Sunday describing how the three Nephites came to his rescue. The room would go quiet. People would really listen and they'd know he was someone important and good. That's the whole point of miraculous stories, isn't it? To let people know that Heavenly Father thought it was worth stopping whatever it was he was doing in order to intervene in your life. Al could hang everything on this story. Build his testimony on it, like the wise man who built his house upon the rock. He cycles past the end of Brother Rimmer's road. He doesn't feel the urge to turn around until he gets to the next junction, and he wouldn't normally pay any attention to such an urge, but it's been a weird morning. So he slips down the side road and heads back. He isn't sure why. All he knows is Brother Rimmer will listen and join the dots together. No doubt, much of what he says will be bonkers. But Al finds he doesn't mind. Brother Rimmer opens the door in his pajamas. You're lucky I've just stuck my teeth in, he says. What's happened? Are you all right? I wanted to tell you something. You better come in then. He follows Brother Rimmer down the hall, past the blue-tacked pictures of the prophets and into the kitchen. Brother Rimmer hefts a cracking bag of peas out of the freezer and wraps it in an orange tea towel. Hold that against your lip. Reckon you can manage a bacon butty? Al lifts the peas away to say, yes, please. Brother Rimmer doesn't put the bacon under the grill. He fries it in a frying pan with a big lump of butter. Then, when it's ready, he dips the bread in the fat, folds it round the bacon, and smacks his lips. They eat standing up in the kitchen. Al takes small bites and chews with his back teeth. There isn't a radiator, but Brother Rimmer's got one of those electric heaters that blow like a hairdryer, and Al stands with his back to it so his trousers can dry. After they've finished eating, he tells Brother Rimmer about being attacked by the lads and rescued by the three old men. Brother Rimmer says the story is the best thing he's heard in ages. He can't be sure whether the men were the three Nephites, largely on account of the dog, which doesn't feature in any of the reports he's heard. However, it's possible they may have decided to get a pet. After all, it must get a bit lonesome and boring wandering the earth until the second coming. Either way, he reckons it's a sign that Heavenly Father is looking out for Alma Bradley. Most likely a miracle, in fact. And because he says it so seriously and thoughtfully, Al can almost believe it. When it comes down to it, a miracle is just an unexpected but welcome change. Water to wine, dead to alive, crap to brilliant. On the way out, Brother Rimmer says, "Go carefully now. Don't do anything daft. You've had your miracle today." Alma's experience allows him to picture people like himself in a spiritual narrative. And it challenges the single story he has been carrying in his consciousness of what it is to be a believer. Chinese dissident poet Yang Lian claimed, "There is no international, only many different locals." If we want a true picture of an international church, perhaps we need to see more of the different locals.
I'm just going to talk a little bit about how I dealt with the same problem in the Friday Gospel. So Caris has spoke about this act of translation and of transformation. And I just wanted to give you one last quote from that Rushdie essay. Jeannie, as I've already read to you, learns early, albeit in a very minor, trivial way, that truth is provisional, that some ideas left untranslated don't travel very well. So Rushdie says, "Those of us who have been forced by cultural displacement to accept the provisional nature of all truths, all certainties, have perhaps had modernism forced upon us." And this comment that Rushdie makes about modernism felt particularly appropriate to my writing practice. Wanting to join the American mosaic actually forced me to create a novel that resembled a mosaic itself. I constructed the five voices of the Friday Gospels because I knew, as the subject matter would be profane, uncorrelated, British and otherwise lacking, I wanted to reserve my efforts for developing an LDS form. I was inspired both by the idea of a choir, US Mormonism's most famous cultural export, and by a wish to both acknowledge and honour the doctrinal, theological and cultural significance of the family within Mormonism. My novel doesn't work until every member of the family is present and gets to speak their own truth in their own words. And there's something as a culture about choirs that we really like, isn't there? The uniformity, perhaps, the many voices singing as one, the harmony, the unity, the sense of belonging. The title of my novel might also unpack a little of the meaning I tried to inflict on the narrative and dramatic structures with which I worked. In Christian mythology, as you know, Friday is the day of death, humiliation, horror, and loss. I was familiar with Aristotle's ideas of dramatic reversal, expressed in his Poetics, and I wondered how the motifs of resurrection, restoration, transformation and conversion might map onto that narratological theory. So that is what I tried to do. This is the Friday where each character suffers. Each character then receives or achieves restoration and reconciliation. And each character finds his or her own story, her gospel, her piece of good news. This method was not led by a wish to translate what was unique, to explain US Mormonism to Brits, British Mormonism to US Mormons, or Mormonism to non-Mormons. Instead, I wanted to uncover and dramatise what might be universal and generally applicable about Mormonism. I wanted to write about the beauty and risk and mystery of faith, hope and forgiveness. this sanctuary, safe harbour, and dysfunctional cage of family, the pressure cooker of small community life, the price of both belonging and individual authenticity, the innocence and hopefulness and hubris of a wish to become perfect, the way patriarchy robs both men and women of authentic relations between each other, the problem of rape culture, slut-shaming, deification of both virginity and motherhood. These are not Mormon issues, or rather, they are not only Mormon issues, they are human issues. To return to Rushdie's remarks, I hoped that my status as a geographically and doctrinally dislocated Mormon, one foot in Zion, one in Chorley, and the third in a nightclub in Manchester, might allow me to speak properly and concretely on a subject of universal significance and appeal. Nearly done. Okay, so to summarise, we both wanted to have our voices heard and acknowledged as part of our home literature, but we also wanted to critique the idea of what home could mean. We're not immune, absolutely not, to the great and delicious irony you will already have noticed in the fact that writers from Africa, India, the former colonies of the British Empire, who are engaged in the act of turning English against their colonisers and claiming their various identities, is what has informed and inspired our thinking in this area. And although Caris and I wrote really different novels, as creative practitioners we faced similar problems in giving Mormonism to a mainstream audience. We opted to engage with these obstacles in different ways. Myself through using universal Christian images of sacrifice, atonement and redemption, along with Mormon motifs like choir and sealed family to structure the narrative. Caris faced the issue head on and unapologetically gives the reader an affectionate, critical look at some distinctive Mormon doctrines and mythologies and translates specifically American folklore into a distinctively British setting. And just before I finish, I want to bring us right back to the start and to Orson Whitney. So he said we'll yet have Shakespeare's and Milton's of our own. And of course it's very gratifying he chose some English writers as his exemplars. But what he also said is, we shall build a literature whose top shall touch heaven, evoking in a way that has always struck me as willfully peculiar the story of the Tower of Babel. This is a fable that warns us of the chaos of multiple stories, multiple mother tongues, of messy, fractured and often unsuccessful attempts at communication. But the tale also ends with the fecund creation of culture, of nationality, of a single people scattered across continents. After Babel, there were many homelands, and in the words of the poet Caris quoted for us earlier, lots of locals. I think Orson Whitney knew that chaotic, multilingual creative endeavour was not destructive. I hope, as creative practitioners occupied by the work of creating imagined homelands, we can still join this wider choir, even if we don't sing in the same place or indeed from the same hymn sheet. Thank you.
He actually took first place in the 2012 D.K. Brown Fiction Contest.
I think we might have run out of...
For sure. Come back this way.
Yeah, right? I think it might be.
Shall we move along?
Sorry.
I feel inadequate to this task as a first-time Sunstone attendee. This listening to the discussion today reminded me of a journey that I took over the course of years, perhaps beginning with my mission to Japan, where the branch president, or bishop, I'm not sure which he was, invited us into his home, and there in his home he had a butsudan, which is a Buddhist shrine to one's ancestors. And I said, well, that's interesting, and he said, yeah. Sometimes when I have a hard day, I come home and I talk to my father, and by father he didn't mean God the Father, he meant his own patriarchal father, and helps him to find his grounding in life. As a missionary, I was really offended. And so how the hell could they let this man be a bishop? But from there, let's follow that journey forward just a little bit. Thereafter, I got to study English with Levi Peterson, and he's my greatest hero, and he helped me through many of my own personal faith struggles. And he wrote this autobiography, a memoir, titled Scoundrel by Nature, Christian by Yearning, that talked about his the atheism that he found on his Mormon mission. And in spite of his lack of belief, his yearning to belong to this Mormon community that was his ancestry and identity, and the community that he participated in for all of his adult life, that he could be a Christian by yearning. And thereafter, let's jump forward to a visit I made to Shifnal in Shropshire a few years ago and attended the Mormon ward there. And the yearning that I felt amongst those British Mormons for implementing the structures of Utah Mormonism as the framework of their practice. And then jump forward now to my most recent spiritual adventures, where this past year Easter came around, and it was announced that our stake was due for a stake conference, and it would be held on Easter. And I thought, if ever there was travesty in the world, that was it. And so I elected to attend the Episcopal Good Shepherd congregation in Ogden on Easter, because I knew that their worship would be more gratifying for me. So there, the Episcopal Good Shepherd, their pastor is from England, and she's got this wonderful British accent, and it was it made me think about a yearning that I might have if I was a Utah Episcopalian for the authentic belief of the Anglicans, and was what I experienced there somehow less than it would have been if I had been able to attend a church in England of the same. And so as I think about all these different belief structures, different congregations, different people who are removed from the home of authenticity, I think back to a conversation that I had once with an anthropology professor about Mormonism, and he was a BYU professor, Dr. Olson, and he suggested that if Mormonism was going to ever truly become a worldwide religion, it would have to drop a lot of the local colloquial worship structures and folk practices and beliefs, or else it just would never be able to be accessible to people around the world, which seems to be true from these various experiences that I've just described, that as long as we are rooted in stories of three Nephites, as long as the hymns are explicit in their reference of the mountains as the core and root of the Mormon practice, then we will never be able to reach people in China or what have you on a wide basis. So then let's move forward now to some of these images from the reading that we just heard, particularly Patriarch Ian standing on the docks, cajoling the youngins into the desired behavior. And it struck me so that that Ian, in his, Ian is the symbol of the patriarchal Utah church, and casting these children as the naive children of foreign mission fields that must be cajoled into this behavior that only suits a Utah worship pattern. And here they are on the docks of the ocean being urged to come to a desert that they would leave the... And it just... It seemed to me that we are being presented with unmet needs of foreign lands and a sluggish imperial culture that is resistant to change and yet resistant to meet the needs, and it urges a different kind of Mormonism. And so here we have a tension between the static correlated narrative versus the urgent local needs, and a search for a Mormon literature that could offer the dialogue between the reader and the author about how to meet these needs. But for it to be a Mormon literature, it seems that it requires that it talk about the struggles of issues of faith, from the questions about God's love or God's will down to basic Mormon truth claims. And it seems that for it to be a Mormon literature, it has to be couched in the Mormon culture, which means these very local folk practices and beliefs. And if we lose those dimensions, then it's no longer a Mormon literature. It's no longer the conversation. But it has to, it seems like quite a tension between all these forces trying to reach the conversation. I really am pleased that you were able to come to present us with your ideas. And I think I've exhausted just about everything I might have to say. So why don't we have a discussion amongst ourselves now between the readers and the authors?
So we have about 15 minutes, and if either of you have the priesthood and want to act as deacons to pass the case.
I've got the priesthood.
Oh, good. Yeah, well, just leave it there on the table.
We're a small crew.
Yeah, we can.
You can just shout.
Yeah,
for the recording.
Oh, for the recording.
Oh,
okay.
I don't know if it's hooked up to the microphone.
Oh.
That's like part of the old days. Nope, it's not hooked up to the microphone. Just shout.
Just start.
I am curious that as you're... The stories that you're telling are very, very Mormon, and yet it's for a British audience who is not very Mormon. Why do you think you need to translate it into American for the American audience?
Oh, you mean the... Yeah, okay.
This sort of question.
So yes, we are. We are telling very Mormon stories, I think, for a British audience. And that does have... It does have certain challenges, I think. When I was doing, I had to do an interview with BBC Radio, and I went in to do this interview, and you sit outside the studio, and that you can hear it's being filtered through into the waiting area, what's being said. And I heard the DJ who was about to interview me live on BBC Radio say, "And after the news, we'll speak to Carrie Spray about her novel, A Song for Izzy Bradley. But before that, we will hear an extract from HBO's Big Love." And I was sat out in the waiting area, just like my heart just sort of went... And I thought, oh my goodness, they really think I'm here to talk about polygamy, or... And then, in fact, what they did is they played, I don't know if any of you have seen Big Love, but they played Barb's excommunication scene, and that was the week that Kate Kelly had been excommunicated, and I had this sort of double panic that they were actually going to put me live on radio to talk about Kate Kelly and ordained women, something I was not in any way, you know, prepared to speak about on national radio, and my heart was just going, and I went in this room and the news was being set, so the DJ was able to talk to me off air, and she sort of said to me, "Oh, did you enjoy that? We thought you'd enjoy that." She said. And that was it. There was no reason. They'd just done it to be nice, and that was what they honestly thought. And I was just so yeah, it is difficult, but I think I did want to sort of just as much as I could just do it, not have to explain, just to present it. Whereas to the sort of removal of anglicisms and stuff in the American edition, that was the American publisher's decision to do that, and I supported it to an extent. I did have a limit. I wouldn't let them change football to soccer, but. Sorry?
Right.
Yeah, absolutely right. I'm not sure if I answered the question, but
I think, I suppose like Caris, I've had interview experiences where I think that I'm going to be talking about my book. When the book first came out, I was on BBC Breakfast, which is the national... That everyone watches this in the morning. This is their morning news programme. And I was terrified. And I had talked with a researcher in advance about the issues in the novel, about how far I was willing to go to talk about my own faith background. And when I got on the couch, they asked me about the American presidential election. Which I did have an opinion about, but I felt... You know, it's a pretty peculiar thing to ask a minor British novelist on British television about, and it was the arts segment. So I think in Britain, the idea that if you're Mormon, you're American, and you have a special interest or a special insight into American politics and culture still stands. I think so. But Caris and I have both published with mainstream British fiction publishers. There are no small Mormon publishers like Signature, for example, in the UK. And if we were to publish with a small kind of Utah Mormon publisher, it's unlikely that British Mormons would be able to buy our books in the shops. So I think some of the issues that are here about getting alternative voices out there are about a publishing industry. And that goes for both ways. You know, there are many mainstream British publishers and American publishers who don't want this book because it's about Mormons. So I think there is a bit of a gap here and a bit of a, you know, things are getting lost, not only in translation, but people somehow don't want to hear it. And I don't know if it's that's readership or that's the industry.
So with this being said, both of you have published novels in England about Mormonism. What stirred the attention of the publishers to pick up on that? Because it is pretty much considered an American religion.
This is my third novel. My first two novels were not Mormon stories. They were very different. And my second novel was about just sort of kind of strange thriller about British teenagers in the 90s. And it was bought as a two-book deal. And when they bought Cold Light, they asked me what the next one was going to be about. And I told them it was about faith and about family, and it would be set in my hometown. And then they bought it, and then later on I sprung Mormonism on them. by which time it had been written and it was too late. It was for me a very conscious decision that the Mormon novel was my third novel, because I didn't want to be pegged as this being the only kind of thing that I did. And the next novel that I'm going to write, although it's about faith, it's not necessarily about Mormonism.
So, yeah, I think I was perhaps in a position where I could demonstrate that this was one of my literary interests.
So it was really different for me, because my first book was a short story collection, and then I wrote the novel, which wasn't to do with Mormonism, and I wrote the novel. My novel is part of my creative writing PhD project. So when I was writing it, I thought I would be really lucky if a really small publisher would take it. And so I never considered that a mainstream, because a division of Random House of Penguin published my novel. I never thought that a mainstream publisher would publish it. But I was very, very lucky, and they really liked it. And yeah, the Mormonism was not an issue for them. In fact, there was an auction, so there were several publishers interested in it. But what has been interesting is that although it's also sold in the US, they can't sell it anywhere else in the world. And they have been trying for almost a year now, and nobody wants it because it's about Mormons.
You go ahead. I was just going to blether to fill some time, but
so Wallace Stegner, who wrote, you know, Mormon Country and stuff, said, "It is almost impossible to write fiction about the Mormons for the reason that Mormon institutions and Mormon society are so peculiar that they call for constant explanation." And one of the things I liked, I confess I haven't read your novel yet, but I've read that one, is you don't explain that much. And it's one of the reasons I liked the Book of Mormon musical, is they just don't explain that much. And I think that especially for us Americans, because we're used to going around the world and telling people about our church, we want to go around the world and tell people about our church, and we don't want to tell the story. We feel like we have to do that before we can tell the stories. So can you talk about what liberated you from feeling like you needed to explain? What made you think that Stegner isn't right?
For me, it was two things. One was that I knew immediately that this would be a book in the first person, and that it would be first person present tense, and people just don't go around explaining their life to themselves. They don't go, "Oh, I'm in the Maya Maze, and this is what it means, and this is where that name comes from, and next year I'll be in the Laurels." They don't. They just get on with their lives. So it was about narrative realism. And the second is about trust in my reader. My editor circled things and said, celestial is not clear in this context. Or they'd say, I'd wrote temple recommend, and she put, temple recommends what? or she'd put, you know, she'd circled and she'd said, no one will know what Ramiumpton means. I don't know what that means. And I think I was quite confident because this is my third novel, and it's very unusual for a writer, especially in the economy the way it is, for the novel to be bought. I was paid for it. It had an ISBN before I'd written it. So really, it was tough. I could be difficult. And I just thought, you know what? They can look it up. None of us are ever very...
It's
yeah, exactly. And I thought, do you know, I have gone through a lot of my life feeling weird and feeling like culture over here is behind glass and I'm not quite allowed into it because it's not church standard and it's something that I don't quite understand. And if I put a non-Mormon reader in that position where something really interesting is going on behind glass that they just don't quite fully get, then that's okay with me. And if there are, I wanted this book to engage and to compel a non-Mormon reader, and it has a very strong plot about a girl who has been harmed and her revenge. It is, you know, it is, there's a story to this. But there's a lot of Easter eggs that if you're Mormon, you're going to get. It's like my little nod to you. And I think that's okay.
Yeah, I agree with what Jen said, and I did have some edits as well, where even just stuff like Heavenly Father, when I wrote Heavenly Father, they were trying to insert the Heavenly Father, and I was like, no, you don't, that's not what Mormons say. And so yeah, it was important to sort of keep that language, and also to trust the reader. I mean, you know, we all read, you read 1984 or something, and it's a completely different world, and it works completely differently, and that's okay, because as a reader, you have to work it out, and you get used to it, and by the end, you should, you know, you should feel like you sort of understand this world and its rules, and so, yeah, they can do the work.
As I've you know, finished the Friday Gospels, and it's done and it's out there, and there's nothing I can do about it, but the novel is currently being adapted for a TV series, and I've had to, and I am script consulting and editing on the scripts, and so we're getting into this process again, and I'm being sent scripts, and you know, there is an awful lot of exposition into, you know, what sealing means and what endowment means, and how these ceremonies fit together. And I, you know, it is my instinct to tell them just to cut all that, because to me, what was not important is explaining strange doctrines or selling the church. What was important was talking about what it felt like to be 14 on this Friday. And the rest of it felt, it was colour. This was, towards the end, the script editor said to me, is this a family who are heading for a car crash because they are Mormons, or is it they're heading for a car crash in spite of being Mormons? And I said, well, I think probably the second. I think it's about some people who happen to be Mormon. So I'm, you know, for this novel and for my style, I felt as little exposition as possible.
We only have time for one question. It's going to be Brock's.
In the information I was sent ahead of time, it seemed that both of you have somewhat distanced yourself from Mormonism as a personal belief system, and yet it seems that your work represents a rather faithful perspective. Could you say anything about that interplay between your own personal belief versus the narrative voice of belief?
Yes, I could say something. Let me try and say something that makes sense. I'm not an active member of the church, but if I had, like, you know, those like little cuddly toys, and they have a little label on them, and it says "Made in China" normally. If I had a label, it would say "Made in Mormonism," and although I'm not an active member of the church, I don't hate the church. I find it very interesting, and my family, my parents are very active in the church, and it will always be a big part of my life. It's always something that will interest me. It's always, and there are some lovely, lovely things about the church, and I wanted in my novel, I wanted to have those lovely things, and I wanted to also have the things that I think, you know, where things maybe don't work as well, or where things where there are conflicts, where things maybe don't make sense, and I wanted all of that, and it's, you know, it's just a sort of big lovely mess of stuff. So yeah, I don't think that the fact that I'm not an active member has any particular bearing on my work, because I have a great fondness for the church, and it's also always going to be a big part of me because it's in my blood and my bones, and so yeah, if that answers the question.
I don't think I would have been a writer if I hadn't have been born a Mormon. I believe that Joseph Smith was an absolutely audacious novelist. that he took a book that he found inadequate and chopped it up and rewrote it and remixed it and did a local cover version. The Friday Gospels is certainly not, I don't think, faithful, although it is respectful and curious about faith. But I think what I am doing is a very Mormon thing to do, which is to use a story to make a mess. And that's that.
That was a good way to end.